Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees. I just got back from NABS on Monday. Must say that Denver throws one hell of a party for visitors. It snowed the entire day Sunday and pretty much closed the airport, and 200 flights were canceled. But I had a ticket to come home on Monday. I did not give up my seat, even though people were being asked, do you want to give up your seat? We'll give you a voucher. I went, no, I want to go home. It was restaurant week in Denver. Anywhere you ate, the chefs were on their best behavior, so I had some great meals. But 2013 NABS is gone. It was excellent. Lots of new builders present. And the way Don Walker works it, you come in the door and all the way down the right side of the hall are small tables for new builders, and you're allowed to have one bike. And there were some really cool looking bikes. All the new builders were so excited, but you could see how nervous they were. So the new Builder of the Year award went to somebody from North Carolina. At least he was born and raised there. His name is Josh Culbertson. And as Velo News reported it, quote, Culbertson is the one-man band of Colorado's Avery County Cycles, a bike company named after a county in the mountains of North Carolina, where Josh spent summers tinkering with his grandfather, who was an engineer and a machinist. Best of Show was a really hot-looking time trial bike from English Cycles out of Eugene, Oregon. It was blue and white, and it was really an engineering marvel. Bike Radar said Eugene, Oregon builder Rob English is on a mission to prove that steel can still be used in ultra-high-performance bicycles when properly designed and engineered. While some of his creations look almost impossibly minimal, English insists that they're structurally sound. This was just a wild-looking bike. I think they had the shifters tucked into the very end of the time trial bar. It was just really a cool-looking bike, very, very modern-looking. Other winners you can see all over the internet. Just type in NABS 2013 and take a look. There were some beautiful bikes there. So one of the highlights of the show for me, and I think we talked about this last week, was the opportunity to co-MC the Smoked Out Live presentation on Saturday evening at the Crown Plaza Ballroom. Mr. Too Tall, Josh Simons from Velocipede Salon, and I took turns posing questions to a panel of rock star builders. Dave Wages from Ellis Cycles, Tim O'Donnell from Shamrock Cycles, Nick Crumpton from Crumpton Cycles, Eric Estlin from Winter, and Rody Walter from Groovy Cycles, along with Gary Smith from Independent Fabrications. It starts a bit slow. We were kind of, you know, asking questions and kind of coaxing the answers out of these builders. But about halfway through, you could see that they'd been like thinking about all these questions. And suddenly they're going, no, I'll answer that. And if you want to see it, there is a video of it. You can go to it's ustream.tv. But I'll put that up on the Facebook page for Outspoken Cyclist. You can go take a look. The actual question and answer period comes in about 29 minutes. Before that, there are some interviews. Actually, I'm interviewed. Gary Smith from IF. Richard Sachs is interviewed, even though he wasn't on the panel. And then Paul Skillbeck, who is the media representative for Don Walker at NABS. So at the same time that NABS was taking place in Denver, the IM Traffic Colloquium was happening in Orlando. Conference was sold out, had a lot of impressive things come out of it. And that segues nicely into tonight's show. Our first guest is Dan Gutierrez. Dan lives in Long Beach, California. He's a senior engineer at Aerospace Corporation. And what does that have to do with cycling? Well, let me tell you, Dan became involved in bicycle transportation issues a long time ago and eventually was asked, well, begged, by the Caltrans or California Transit Authority people to teach all the district engineers about his class, Understanding Bicycle Transportation. The class has had a tremendous influence on better sharrow replacements and bike lane designs, and what is also one of the very popular workshops of the IM Traffic Conference in Orlando. So we are privileged this evening to be able to break down the workshop, discover the difference between equality and equity, which is a very important topic as it pertains to bicycles, and Dan will help us wrap up the IM Traffic Conference. We'll also talk with Dex and Johnny Took, who live and work and ride in Del Rio, Texas, right on the Mexican border. Dex is able to ride virtually 365 days a year, he says, and we're jealous. He is an ultra-distance cyclist and was only the sixth person over the age of 60 to complete RAM on his second attempt. Johnny is the crew chief and support for Dex's efforts as well as his life. Dex and Johnny will join us to talk about RAM, ultra-distance racing, and about his ride, No Country for Old Men, in the second half of the show. We'll also take time to do a little bit of news. So let's welcome Dan Gutierrez to The Outspoken Cyclist. Dan, thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Diane. I'm very happy to be here.
One of the most important tenets of your work is the six E's. So I'd like to begin our conversation about that, and we'll get into IM traffic and some of the things that went on at the colloquium this past weekend after that.
Okay, that's great. So let me take you on a little walk down memory lane.
Okay.
It turns out that before 2007, we had the five E's: education, engineering, enforcement, encouragement, and evaluation, which were used to classify bicycling efforts or the spheres of influence where advocates could work to improve bicycling. Now, as we were working as an advocate to try to help improve bicycling across these different areas, we noticed a recurrent theme that there were problems because of laws. Turns out that most U.S. states have laws that restrict bicyclists compared to motorists, so they end up being kind of a class-based discrimination. And what happens is that it makes it more difficult to teach bicycling skills because of the complexity and additional restrictions. Bicyclists were sometimes unfairly blamed for collisions or cited for engaging in what we instructors would consider lawful and safe behavior. So we noticed that many of the E's were influenced by an external thing, this law thing. And what I realized in 2007 is that, wow, there's a missing E, that bicycling equality is the sixth E. And in fact, I discussed this with board members of the League of American Bicyclists, including Amanda Eichstadt, who is the president. And we co-wrote an article that talked about the sixth E and published that in December of 2007. In the American Bicyclist magazine, the article was titled "Equality for Cyclists: Why We Need a Sixth E." And from that, the board decided that it was important to capture the sixth E and the notion of fairness and equity, and actually publish a statement called the Equity Statement, which was published in 2009. I know a lot about the background of it because a couple of the board members, John Allen being one of them, and Amanda Eichstadt, asked me to ghostwrite it. So I actually had composed the equity statement, which they had then wordsmithed with the board and published it. So it talked about how the league should deal with all six of the E's moving forward in advocacy. So at that time, many of us were really excited. We were thinking, wow, you know, the league has really embraced the six E's, and we're going to really take off, and we're going to see a big emphasis on getting rid of the bad laws and improving education. And, well, it never really panned out. They didn't really carry it into further policies. So it's not necessarily a criticism of the league so much as a recognition that their focus was probably more on encouragement and engineering via infrastructure. So it was a different focus.
So this six E's, out of those, two of them, equality and equity, are coming up. So define the difference between equality and equity.
Oh, sure. The sixth E always was equality. In fact, if you go look at that American Bicyclist article, you'll see that we defined it as, and let me explain the difference between the words equality and equity. It's really simple, actually. Equality means same. So if you look at any user of the road in a wheeled vehicle, they should follow the same movement rules and have the same basic rights. In other words, they should be equal or have movement or legal equality. Now, equity is the notion of fairness. In other words, let's say that bicyclists are 5% of the transportation users in a city, and motorists are 95%, then it would be equitable or fair that bicyclists receive 5% of the transportation funding and the motorists get the other 95%. So they're complementary ideas. Equality has to do with bicyclists' rights, particularly their ability to make safe movements, and equity applies to all six of the E's. In other words, it's fair to treat bicyclists as equal road users. It's fair to give them an equitable share of engineering funding. It's equitable to enforce laws in ways that bicyclists are treated equally, and so on and so forth for the other E's.
But it doesn't work that way.
Well, it doesn't always work that way.
Well,
we would like to see that become the prime directive for advocacy, as it were.
5% would be huge right now.
Well, it would be. I picked it just because it was an easier talking
okay.
number. The national average is closer to 1%
yes.
at present.
Yes.
But I'd like to see it at a higher
yeah,
level.
Yeah, that would be nice, too. So then let's move on to the I Am Traffic Colloquium. And first, tell us how you see the difference between what the LAB is doing and what I Am Traffic is doing, and then we'll move forward.
Many of us, John Schubert was one of them, tried to form a similar organization to I Am Traffic about 12 years ago. And one of the difficulties we had is that we didn't really have a unifying theme and products to rally around, but we do for I Am Traffic. In order to further the six E's, a number of us have been working very much in the education sphere. And if you look at the conference, the colloquium, I should say, we talked a lot about the education program Cycling Savvy, which is for cyclists. We talked about the Understanding Bicycle Transportation course that I teach to transportation professionals. We talked about Journeys from Home, which teaches bicycling safety skills to children. We also talked with Kirby Beck about the International Police Mountain Bike Association's efforts to discuss and train officers. So what we have are a number of education programs that we would like to unify into a whole and combine that with advocacy that puts a heavy emphasis on equality and education, because we'd like to see equal laws for the United States for bicyclists, and we don't have that in most states. So the goal of I Am Traffic is to make sure, and I'll read the vision statement. I think that really lays it out. The drivers of human-powered vehicles are expected and respected as a normal part of traffic. And that captures the notion of equality and how it plays through all of the engineering, the education, the enforcement, the encouragement, and the evaluation.
We're speaking with Dan Gutierrez. He's out in El Segundo, California, at his office. He is an aerospace engineer and a very cycling savvy dude, and I'm using that purposely so Carrie will hear it. So do you think your Understanding Bicycle Transportation program could be used in other states? Have other states asked about it or looked for it?
Yes, I've had inquiries from a number of states. And it turns out the way that the information is structured, the bulk of it relates to things that are common in the MUTCD, which is the Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, which is the traffic control Bible for all of the country. And when I say traffic control, I mean things like signs, signals, stripings, markings, all the stuff you put on the road to guide and control drivers. And it turns out that a lot of the policies and laws in California are not that dissimilar, so I would need to tweak the course a little bit to make it reflect some of the specifics of some other states. It turns out that in terms of the legal part, states like Texas and Florida are very similar to California, so it wouldn't be a big stretch. So one of the plans we have is to both extend it to versions for other states and then certify other instructors to do the kind of teaching that I'm doing, so that I don't have to be all over the country. We can have a small cadre of instructors who can then deliver the material and hopefully improve the state of knowledge of transportation professionals with respect to bicycling.
So the colloquium is starting to pull together the kinds of things you're doing with the kinds of things Carrie is doing and a bunch of other people. When I talked to John Schubert earlier today, he mentioned what you and Brian D'Souza are doing. Why don't you explain how your traffic cams work? Because it's fascinating that one of you is filming in front and one of you is filming in back.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we have a name for that. We call it dual chase view. And let me just explain that briefly. If you just put a helmet camera on your head and you shoot a view of traffic, what you see are cars, but you don't see yourself. So the person looking at the video can't tell how close the cars are to you, or exactly what your relationship is to the other vehicles on the road. And so as a teaching tool, it's not particularly useful. So right from the beginning, I worked with Chris Quinton, the cyclist I view, to have me follow him or lead him and have the camera pointed at him so you could see him and the traffic either in front of him or behind him, depending on whether he was behind me or in front of me. And that's nice because you can see half of what you need to see. But wouldn't it be cool if you could see the traffic in front of a bicyclist and the traffic behind them at the same time?
Yeah, right? Exactly.
So what we did is that Brian and I hit upon the idea, hey, Brian, I'll be in front and I'll turn my camera around facing backwards to shoot you and the traffic behind you. And you'll point your camera forward at me and you'll shoot me and the traffic in front of me. And then we'll synchronize the video and do a picture-in-picture window, which if you go to our YouTube channel, Cyclist Lorax, and you look at the video called The Rights and Duties of Bicyclists, which is our most popular video, has 100,000 views, which is pretty good for a two-man safety video.
Right.
That shows that view that you can look in the rear view and see a car changing lanes to pass Brian behind me, and then in my front view, you can see it coming around to the front. So it allows bicyclists to understand that what traffic does when they act like a driver. And it shows that basically in a very visual and immersive way that when you act like a driver, you get treated like one in a way that you can't actually see when you're riding your bike because we're not like those spiders that have eyes in the back
right.
of their head, you know?
Exactly. That's fascinating. What's the YouTube channel again?
It's called Cyclist Lorax.
Okay. We'll put a link up to that.
And I forgot to add one more thing.
Yeah, sure.
The LA County, LA Metro, our transportation authority and metropolitan planning organization that funds bicycling, they were sufficiently impressed with the video technology we developed. We actually won a Diamond Award in 2006 for that development. So I should have referred to it as our award-winning video technology, Dual Chase View.
And you just did. So there you
yes,
have it.
I did.
So how did you become so involved in cycling? You're an aerospace engineer, and how do you find all this time?
Well, that's because it's an important part of my life. And to make that clear, I need to tell you the real reason why I got involved in bicycling. You know, I could give you the flowery story about how it's good for the environment, it's clean, it's healthy. But let me tell you what really happened. When I first learned to ride a bike as an 8-year-old, I loved it. It gave me freedom to travel, to go where I wanted to go. I could go long distances by myself on a bike. And what really did it for me, our parents were driving us up into the San Bernardino Mountains on one of the main highways, and I saw a guy on a road bike climbing up that mountain. It's like a 5,000, 6,000-foot climb all by himself on a road bike, and I knew right then and there, I want to do that. And that's what got me started, my strong interest in bicycling. And then later, after I got out of college and started and finished my education work and started doing my professional work, I noticed that bicycle planning, bicycle facilities, it was a fragmented afterthought. And I said, you know, I'd like to help. And it turns out that there's kind of a relationship between my aerospace skills. And the government has spent a lot of money training me to be a professional advocate for the Air Force for their military space systems. When they go to a Lockheed or a Boeing to buy these multi-billion-dollar constellations, it's my job to make sure their interests are being looked out for. Well, those skills translate naturally into looking out for the interests of bicyclists with public agencies, private agencies. So a lot of the same skills transfer back and forth. And it's been very fortuitous for me. So it's actually helped my professional career and my advocacy work. So even though it might seem odd at first, there's actually a natural connection.
So let's go back to the colloquium for a moment.
Sure.
What's going to come out of it in the long term? What do you hope is going to come out of it?
Looking down the road, what I think, if I speak for the consensus of the people at the colloquium, and I gave a couple of talks at the colloquium about the 6 E's and about the Understanding Bicycle Transportation course, and we talked a lot about where we were going. But I think the issue is that we can take all of our education products and unify them into a whole and get the word out about bicyclists being a normal, expected, and respected part of traffic as drivers, and that we'll work on repealing the bad laws, putting out the PSAs, doing the work to make people and help people in the U.S. understand that bicycling is a normal activity. And I think it's important to have that education and equality focus because I could make analogies to the civil rights movement. But until you have equal legal status, you're always a second-class user, a second-class road citizen, as it were. And that's an important thing to fix. But a lot of it has to do with the history, and we can get into that a little bit later on. But I think the main thrust of the organization is to make sure that in the forefront of people's minds that bicyclists are drivers who have the same rights as other people, and that the skills you need to do it are easy things to learn that, frankly, really should be integrated into our school system.
I absolutely believe that that's true, and it needs to start at that age, certainly not after you're an adult. So do you think that the colloquium and that group will somehow replace the League of American Bicyclists, or are they going to be different? Are they going to be clashing? What's going to be happening?
It's a different focus.
Okay.
In other words, my intention is not to attack the League or to try to make the League go away. The League has a long history. And my intention in all this is to make sure that we bring a strong education focus and equality focus to the forefront of advocacy. I think the League does a little bit more focus on the engineering part and the encouragement. So in many ways, I think that our roles could be complementary as we move forward. So I'm a big proponent, both in my personal and professional and advocacy life, of leading by example. And I think that's true of all the others at the colloquium.
I guess, you know, as I've heard some people talk in the past, and certainly not right now, and I've been to the summit several times, and the summit's coming up this week, I see it as that opportunity to go up on Capitol Hill and make your case to your legislators. And yet I know there's a lot of other things that happen in the LAB. So I'm wondering, I Am Traffic, what's going to happen? What are the things that you're going to actually focus on in terms of getting the word out? Are you going to be doing that kind of advocacy, legislative advocacy? I'm trying to see what the differences are.
Well, I'm envisioning that I Am Traffic will certainly have a national umbrella with the I Am Traffic website. But I envision that we'll be doing a lot of work at the state level with state chapters and state organizations, because if you want to fix the laws that are inequitable, you've got to do that at the state level.
Yep.
That's not something you do at the national level. In terms of equity of funding, yes, that's a national level focus. And the League has that well covered. We may participate in that, we may not. But a lot of the focus that we have will probably be focused much more at the state level, particularly in terms of the equality and education. And I think we already have a number of programs that are functioning well in a number of states, which can be spread to other states. So that basic core of cycling savvy, understanding bike transportation, journeys from home, and the police education can be spread to a much larger set of states. And I think that's an important goal for us.
Well, so here's probably the contentious question, and that is, we have cycling savvy, which is, I think, a very good program. And then you have the LCI program. I think that's what it's
called. Smart Cycling is what it's called.
Yeah. And so they're very different from one another. And they focus on two different things. You know, are they going to be butting heads? You know, they've got all these instructors trained, these LAB instructors. And now I know Carrie's training new people. What do you think's going to be the dominant training program? Or is that possible?
Well, I don't look at this in terms of domination and submission or competition so much as the fact that Cycling Savvy was engineered to help people break that feeling that they don't belong and have them understand their role in traffic. And Carrie can speak much more eloquently on this topic than I ever could, because she's one of the creators of the program. But in many ways, the way I prefer to look at it is that Cycling Savvy was designed to take people who don't realize their place in traffic and help them better understand that they can participate in traffic cooperatively, safely, and frankly, calmly. And that is a major focus of the program. I think the League program didn't have so much of a focus on the psychology so much as it does on the skills training. And I think that's one of the advantages. Now, keep in mind that Carrie was able to look at the League program and then do her best to take the best elements and then add the psychology part, and I think make a more comprehensive program that appeals to all facets of the person. So in that way, I think it's a very significant achievement.
So what is the next step for I Am Traffic?
Well, the next step for IM traffic, and I should have mentioned this earlier, one of the key, the way the colloquium went was that we had all of our discussions of our products and what we could do on Saturday. Then on Sunday, we said, hey, now it's time to stand up this organization. And what we rapidly realized is that, you know, we're not going to do all this in a few hours to create the bylaws, decide who the members are, and go through all the formal structure that you need to create to incorporate and really have the organization take off. So we agreed to create a formation board. And that formation board has five members who are going to be working closely together. And by the way, those five members are Mike Wilson in Orlando, Jen Bowers in Kentucky, Waco Moore in Dallas, Texas, Lisa Walker, who's also in Orlando, and myself. And we're going to be putting together all the structure for the organization and creating the framework so that all these goals and the six E's that we talked about will be built into that structure.
All right. So is there a time frame for this?
Our working time frame is to have the organization stood up and put together within the next 6 months, and we'll have interim checks with the rest of the people in the group to see, check our progress and get ourselves toward incorporation.
All right. Well, I learned a lot, as I always do, and I had wanted to be down there in Orlando, but now I sort of feel filled in, so I appreciate you taking time to talk with me this evening. And we will follow IM Traffic and take a look at your YouTube videos, and I really am glad to have been able to talk with you.
Could I say one more thing before
of
we part company?
Of course.
I think it's really important.
Go ahead.
One of the goals of IM Traffic is to change the way cycling and cyclists are viewed in the U.S. And I just wanted to tell you that we need to get back to the future. Back when the first traffic laws were created, bicyclists were drivers just like motorists. They didn't make a distinction between them in law. But in the 20s, motoring interests started trying to kick everybody who wasn't a motorist off the roads. And after 90 years of that, people don't see themselves, bicyclists in particular, as drivers anymore. And what we really want to do to get back to the future is to reclaim our lost driver heritage so that we teach people in the future that roads are for people, not just people in cars. So I'll leave you with that thought.
Well, and I hope that that happens. I think that would be awesome. And I hope I live long enough to see it. Well, Dan, thank you so much. I hope to meet you someday in person. And maybe the next IM Traffic Colloquium, I'll be there.
I would love to meet you. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you. Have a great night. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We were talking with Dan Gutierrez, part of the IM Traffic Colloquium from his office in El Segundo, California. And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
Every day, I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit AARP.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees. We're going to do some news. This is from Forbes, and it is more about Armstrong, but this might answer a question that's been asked more than once. Erica Kelton writes about whistleblower cases for Forbes, and she posed and answered a series of questions, including this one. Armstrong's lawyers have argued that the Postal Service made more money from the sponsorship than it paid to sponsor Armstrong and his team. If that is true, why should Armstrong have to pay the government any money? And here's the answer. Even if the Postal Service did receive some benefit from the success of Armstrong's team, it should not and will not negate any potential liability under the False Claims Act. The Postal Service's gain is irrelevant to the question of whether Armstrong broke the law. If Armstrong and other defendants procured $30 million from the U.S. government by falsely promising to abide by anti-doping requirements, then they will be liable no matter what gain the U.S. government might have received. particularly since the Postal Service's gain was based on the team's extraordinary success due to doping. Remember, Armstrong himself said that without doping, the team would not have won. Whether there should be an offset for any gains received by the Postal Service is purely a question of damages. Machen's statements have indicated his belief that the Postal Service suffers continuing harm from being associated with Armstrong's team, which is important to note. This suggests that the United States may argue that its damages are far greater than the contract's $30 million. And in fact, as I've been reading, they're talking triple damages. So that would be like $90 million. So I don't know if any of you ride and listen to music at the same time, which I like to tell people not to do. But there may be a way of doing that. I'm not a big believer in this, but after seeing this, it's possible. The company is called Aftershocks, and it's AfterShokz. And the sound is actually transmitted through your cheekbones just in front of your ears without actually covering your ears. The little device uses a standard plug that should go into iPhones, Androids, iPads, iPods. As far as I can tell, every conceivable device. The headphones have received a ton of technology awards. And while I'm not sure if they work, I'm always warning you, don't necessarily ride and cover your ears. This might be a sensible answer. So if anybody out there wants to give them a try and let me know, it's www.aftershocks.com. National Bike Month is coming up in May, which seems like it's far away, especially here. It's freezing up here. The League of American Bicyclists is asking you to share your best idea for showcasing cycling. There is a, quote, please tell us your bike month success story, end quote, form. LAB team says, we are writing to ask for your help. We are showcasing 50 great ideas for bike month in an upcoming issue of American Bicyclists. So there is a link on bikeleague.org if you're interested. They're saying it should take less than 5 minutes of time and that you have to get your application in by March 13. So this is actually a Cleveland notice, and it's not till 2014, but it's kind of a big deal. This is going to be a huge amount of people coming to Cleveland for not just bicycling, some other athletic events. The International Gay Games are going to be held in the Cleveland Akron area August 9th through 14th of 2014. The original games began in 1982, and they're held every 4 years. Dr. Tom Waddle, who conceived the games in 1980, is quoted to say, the gay games are not separatists, they are not exclusive, they are not oriented to victory, and they are not for commercial gain. They are, however, intended to bring a global community together in friendship, to experience participation, to elevate consciousness and self-esteem, and to achieve a form of cultural and intellectual synergy. 11,000 athletes from all over the world will compete in dozens of sports, including cycling and triathlon. And what's always cool about an event like this coming to an area is the enormous economic impact that not just the athletes bring, but all those who come and support them. So I think that's pretty cool that we're going to have a huge event like that, even though it's another like year and a half away. So we all know we are losing our Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, who has just been an incredible champion of cycling in his term as Secretary in the Obama administration. This comes from streetsblog.org by Tanya Snyder, and the headline is U.S. Department of Transportation to challenge AASHTO supremacy on bike ped safety standards. And it's interesting because the Secretary of Transportation decided to make an announcement at AASHTO as opposed to the Bike Summit because he seems to be trying to bring AASHTO into the fold of a movement to embrace more innovative bikeway designs. He said, I'm asking the cycling community for their help, but I'm asking you to be helpful also. That's what he told state officials. I know most of you want to build the 21st century infrastructure and that your communities need to be competitive. The problem is we don't have modern day roadway standards to help us bring ideas to life. LaHood noted that he would be meeting with cyclists at the Bike Summit in Washington, which is next week, by the way, and that he would work with them on ways to improve infrastructure, quote, to make biking and walking opportunities as safe as they possibly can be. So hopefully out of the Bike Summit and this ASHTO meeting, which is the National Association of City Transportation Officials, more good will come for biking and walking in the future. And that's all the news I've got right now. We're wrapping that up, and then we're going to head down to Del Rio, Texas, right on the Mexican border, where we're going to talk to Dex and Johnny Took. Dex is an ultra-distance cyclist, and Johnny is his crew support in cycling and life. Thanks for joining us on the show this evening.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Doing great, thanks.
Yeah, and you have perfect weather in Texas, huh?
It is nice.
Yeah.
It is nice today.
That's not fair. So, Dex, I'd like to begin with you. You know, evidently you know our friend Jim Karlovec.
Yes.
And he is a good friend of ours. I'd like to get some background on you and your entry into cycling. Whatever compelled you to become an ultra-distance rider?
Well, I've been training and racing for over 30 years, and I started out running and then got into the triathlons and the marathons, and I've run the Boston Marathon, and then I got into ultra running and actually started doing some 24-hour track races where I would run like 100 miles in one day around the track. And I eventually got so injured from the running that I had to quit that. And so in the year 2000, I started dedicating all my training strictly to cycling. And I just started cycling, and then in 2006, I did my first ultra race. And so I've been doing ultra racing, meaning the mega mileage, since 2006.
So I have a question about your ultra distance running, just because I don't know anything about it. How long does it take to run 100 miles on a track?
It was 24 hours.
Oh, it was
a 24-hour race.
So it was as long as you could go for 24 hours?
As many miles as you could go for 24 hours, yes.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So you got injured, you got onto a bike, and I know that long-distance riders like you just put in a mind-boggling amount of miles every year.
Yes.
How do you do that? You still have a full-time job, yes?
Yes, I do. Typically during the week, Monday through Friday, I get up early. I'm usually on the highway by 4:30 or 5 in the morning, and I'm doing a specific workout of, say, 15 to 18 miles at that time, and then I come home, and then I change bicycles and get on my commuter bike, and I commute to work, and that's about a 25-mile round trip every day. And then on weekends, I try to do some long stuff where I do at least a century every Saturday, and then try to follow it up with another long ride on Sunday, and then maybe once a month do a double century or something like that.
Wow. So you ride truly between 18 and 20,000 miles a year.
Yeah. I average about, for all 365 days a year, I average about 3 hours a day workout.
Hmm. When you put it like that, it doesn't sound so, you know, so daunting.
Well, the trick to that is that it's all 365 days. So that means if you miss a day or if you travel or if you do anything, then, you know, you've got some ground to make up.
That's true. Let me ask Joni a few questions. Hi, Joni.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm okay.
Good. So we'll get back to Dex in a second. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you sort of became Dex's crew chief.
Well, you know, we've been married many, many moons, 40 years, and I've got my own interest and all, but I've always supported Dexter. Anytime he got interested in anything, I would go along, and whenever he would go to races, I would go along, so I would just naturally supported him just as his wife. Now, the crew chief for this long-distance stuff occurred after 2010 RAM attempt. And after that was over, I said, okay, I know if I really put forth a lot of effort on my part, if I'm the crew chief, I really think we can get this done.
Uh-huh.
And I just kind of pushed my way in there and said, I'm going to be crew chief. And that's what compelled me to do it was the failed attempt in 2010, which, you know, in a way it really wasn't a failure. It just didn't quite finish in time, you know. And I'm a natural organizer, and so I just kind of took the job.
Well, behind every great man, you know.
Well, that's what they say.
Well, evidently, in your case, it is true. So do you ride at all?
No.
Okay.
I do not. I will walk. I've done different kinds of exercising, from aerobics to walking. I do some spinning on the spin cycles.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, I tried riding one time on a barred bicycle, and it freaked me out. It's just too out and too exposed. And so I thought, I can't do that.
Well, I think what you do is pretty important. So I know that the 2010 Ram event was a non-finish, a DNF. So what did you find, Joni, the most difficult part of that event?
Was stopping. When Dexter announced that we don't have enough time to finish, we're going to have to stop, and I argued. I fought it, and that was the hardest part for me. Nobody knew after everybody went back to the motel, and I stayed up way past whenever I should have been sleeping, because I was working on the van and working on the RV and trying to get things ready for the next day and having to take off the signage. And it was just, it was an emotional letdown for me. And I think it was at that point when we got back to the motel and it really hit, it's done, it's over, and we didn't make it. And it was very disappointing for me. That was really tough on me.
So, Dex, we're going to get back to Joni because I have another question about the 2011 event, but I'd like to just back into the 2010 Ram for you first. And that is, you considered it unfinished business and actually wrote a book about both your 2010 and 2011 Ram races.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your experience of the 2010 event and then how that translated into being successful in 2011.
Well, first of all, the 2010 event, most solo riders anyway that attempt Ram have either crewed it before for someone else, or they've maybe been on a team and done it, or their crew has been experienced in some way. Everyone, myself and all my crew in 2010, no one had ever even seen the Ram course, knew what Ram was or anything. We were totally green. And it's a logistical nightmare to get eight people, two vehicles, and a lunatic on a bicycle across America in 12 days.
You're absolutely right.
And we didn't have any experience at all. But we were doing pretty good until we got to Colorado, and then at Colorado the weather hit. And I can remember in 2010, I was in Monument Valley. It was the wee hours of the night. And I remember hearing this military marching music coming up behind me, and it was Yuri Robic. And Yuri pulled up beside me, and he was very courteous and very respectful to me. And he spoke broken English, and I asked Yuri, I said, Yuri, what's your goal for this year? And Yuri told me he wanted to break 8 days. And that was when we were in Monument Valley. And it was, and what Yuri and I, neither one knew at that time, was what lay ahead of us as far as weather when we hit Colorado. And the weather was so harsh that Yuri not only didn't break 8 days, it was his slowest Ram ever, and he didn't break 9 days.
Wow.
There were, I'm trying to remember the numbers. In 2010, I think it was either 36 or 31 solo riders in the race. And 10 finished it. I was number 11 on the road. I was the last guy out there. And it was just, the weather from Colorado on was just really bad. And I was a rookie, and I didn't know what I was doing. And then to be able to take all of that, take the bad weather, take the experience of having gone across America once and the logistics of it all, the learning curve coming back for 2011 was huge. We had a huge learning curve. So that's what I attribute to being successful in 11, was the experience from 2010.
Oh, I can imagine. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dex and Joni Took down in Texas about unfinished business that became finished business. So you wrote the book after the 2011 Ram races, and you titled it Unfinished Business, but by that time it was finished. Tell us about chronicling these two events. How did you? I haven't actually seen a copy of the book because when Jim told me I needed to talk to you, which I'm really glad that I am talking with you, he never mentioned a book.
Okay. I wrote Unfinished Business. I was encouraged by several people, but most strongly by one of my crew members. And I really didn't have an interest to write the book. But my 2011 campaign, my RAM campaign, was all already titled Unfinished Business. It was written on my RV. It was publicized in the papers and on the radio programs. I mean, I went into RAM with Unfinished Business being my campaign. And then after I completed RAM, one of my crew members really started pushing me to write the book. And then in November of 2011, I had a medical procedure done, and I had to be off my bicycle for 6 weeks, no riding whatsoever. And I hadn't been off my bicycle more than 8 days in a row for 25 years. So I knew it was going to be hard, so I thought, well, this is when I'll write the book. And so I did start writing it at that time, and then I completed it in March. And the book is the book just chronicles a little bit. It goes into a little bit of 2010 and my how I was not successful in 2010, although I did make it 2,820 miles.
That's almost all of it.
Almost all of it. And then it chronicles from time station to time station the entire 2011 race.
Looking back to 2010 and 2011, did you have any of the same physical issues? Because a lot of people complain of like neck problems and obviously saddle problems. What kinds of issues did you run into in 2010 that you were able to remedy in 2011, if there were any?
One of the problems I had in 2010, I had several. Everybody has physical issues and injuries in RAM. There's no one that's ever done RAM that doesn't get saddle sores. In 2010, one of the big problems I had was a condition called hot foot, where your feet are just burning like crazy.
Yep.
And at that point, I was actually using some carbon shoes, and it was actually about 3 months after RAM in 2010 before I could even ride for more than 20 or 25 miles, because my feet had these knots of nerves in them from the RAM, and I learned then that I needed a more flexible shoe. Another thing that happened to me in 2010 was the palms of my hands became so traumatized and bruised from the hours of riding and standing up on my handlebars and climbing, because I do stand a lot when I ride. The palms of my hands became so bruised that I couldn't even hardly lay them down on top of a handlebar. They were so sensitive. So in 2011, to remedy those problems, I did go to the flexible shoe, and I did have some hot foot issues in 2011, but nothing compared to what I had in 2010. As far as the hands, in 2011, I decided I wasn't going to have that problem with bruising my palms as I did in 10. So what I did was I started riding, climbing the hills differently with my hands resting on my hoods rather than in my drops. And so the webbing of my hand between my thumb and my forefinger was resting on my hood, and it took the pressure off my palm. The downside of that is that I had much worse hand problems in 2011 than in 10, because I've got some permanent nerve damage in my hands.
Mm.
And it was months before I could, after RAM in 11, I couldn't button a shirt, I couldn't zip my pants. Johnny Velcroed my pants for me. I would stop at a gas station and have to ask the lady at the next pump to take my gas cap off for me.
Wow!
It was really bad. But that was just from changing the position on the bars with your hands. As far as the Schirmer's neck, I've been fortunate through both rams. I didn't experience Schirmer's neck.
What kind of a bike do you use for RAM?
In 2011, I used a Specialized Roubaix.
It's carbon?
Yes, it's mm-hmm. carbon, and I used a Campy 11 components.
Nice. So, Joni, after your disappointment that you didn't see him finish in 2010, how did you feel when he finished in 2011?
Well, really, it was more like relief. You know, it's like, oh, good, we finally got this done. You know, check that off the list. It was exciting to me to know that, and it was very emotional because to see what he could do on that bike is really inspiring, even to me. When he's pushed a little harder and you see what he does, and it's like, wow, how does he do that? So it was inspirational, but more relief was like, oh, whew, we got that one done.
Diane, one thing I think you should recognize is that even though we did have the huge learning curve and everything in 2011, we were under the gun in 11. It was very close to being another DNF for me because I wasn't going to make the time cutoff. The last 30 hours of Ram, let's say the last 300 miles when we were in West Virginia and going through the Appalachians, I had one 15-minute nap in the last 30 hours.
Wow.
I only completed Ram 1 hour and 14 minutes before the cutoff in 11, so it wasn't like I just breezed through it in 11. I mean, we were under the guns. In fact, we were behind the projected cutoff for a lot of the last third of the race.
I want to move to something that evidently, did this come out of Ram, No Country for Old Men?
No Country for Old Men is a race that I direct out in West Texas in a very rugged part of Texas. It's where it gets its name from the namesake of the movie because that's where the region of the race is where
right.
The movie was filmed.
Did you see the movie?
Oh, yes.
It's wild, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, yeah, well, I love the Coen
Brothers. But it's not as wild as the race.
Oh, okay, well, tell us.
But anyway, it's a part of Texas that I've always wanted to have a race out there. It's like riding your bicycle back in the 1950s. It's like it's just so remote, so rugged, so solitude, and I've always wanted a race out there. It's an ultra race. It's a Ram-style race, meaning that you have to have a follow vehicle and a crew, just like you do in Ram. The race is 383 miles long. I just don't understand how coincidentally it ended up being the same mileage as my Ram number, but it did.
Oh, interesting. That was your Ram number, 383?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how that worked out.
But it goes through the rugged Big Bend country, Alpine Davis Mountains. It goes up the elevations up around 6,700 feet. It goes through temperature ranges of anywhere from 40 degrees to 100 degrees. There is a lot of climbing in the race. It's a very difficult course, and it's just one that I've always wanted to happen. It's not a race for the masses. You're not going to have a lot of people out there because it's very remote. Even if you want to fly in to come to the race, you're still going to be 200 or 300 miles from the race after you fly in.
How many people did it in 2012?
Solos, I think we had five, and then we had three teams, I think it was.
Yeah, we had three teams, but one team wasn't able to make it, so we ended up with just two teams.
They had a mechanical problem.
Yeah.
There's a time limit to this event?
Yes, 32 hours.
And did everybody who enter finish?
No, there was one DNF in the solo and one DNF in the teams, but the ones that didn't DNF did finish within the 32-hour time limit, yes.
Are you doing the race again this year?
Yes, I am. I'm doing it October the 12th, and we're right now working on adding a new distance to the race.
Longer or shorter?
Shorter. We're trying to get a 12, something in the neighborhood of 10 to 12 hours and 175 to 200 miles, something like that. And we're going to become part of there's a race series in Texas called the Texas Ultra Cup. And the Texas Time Trials, Bessie's Creek, the Ram Challenge Series, 24 Hours in the Canyon are all races in the Texas Ultra Cup. And racers can go to these races and earn points. And then at the end of every season, the Texas Ultra Cup champion is crowned. And so the No Country will become part of the Texas Ultra Cup.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you one last question before I let you go, and that is, what advice would you give someone who wanted to become an ultra-distance rider?
It takes the P word, and the P word is passion. it takes a lot of dedication, a lot of discipline. But if you have the passion to do it, it's something that if the bug bites you, you'll be hooked or addictive, as some of us call it. And I just think that it's a good sport. It's a dangerous sport. Don't get me wrong. It's very dangerous out there on the highway. But it's a sport that can get in your blood and become part of your passion. I believe we all have a very, very deep reserve, and very few of us ever tap into that reserve. But I believe we all have a deep reserve, and you can tap into that, and what you find in there is really special.
This has just been wonderful. Jim Karlovic was right that I would just love talking with you and Joni, too. Why don't you let our listeners know how they can find out about No Country for Old Men?
They can go to ultradex.net, and they can find out information about the race there. They can also find information out about the book, Unfinished Business. Of course, the book is available also at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or any Internet bookstore. It's available also as an e-book.
Are you doing RAM in 2013?
Actually, Johnny and I both are doing RAM in 2013. We are helping crew one of the top contenders, Marco Ballo from Slovenia.
Wow.
Marco is coming over, and I think the 2013 RAM is going to be one of the most exciting RAMs ever. There are probably, it's the deepest field of contenders ever, I know for sure. There are 7 or 8 solo riders in 2013 RAM that can win this thing, any one of them. And it's going to be very exciting. And so for once, I'm going to be at the front of RAM instead of at the rear of RAM. And I'm really looking forward to it. Marco, in fact, came from Slovenia and did my No Country for Old Man race. He was, of course, the winner of the race.
Yeah.
and he actually stayed here with me. We did some training here in Del Rio while he was here. But Johnny and I both are very excited to be crewing Marco in RAM this year.
Well, such good luck to you, to Johnny, to Marco, to the whole RAM 2013 slew of riders. And for No Country for Old Men, we'll be watching that one. Thank you so much for talking with me this evening. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Diane.
All righty. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Johnny and Dex Took out in Del Rio, Texas, right on the Mexican-Texas border. Amazing guy. He's 63 years old and one of the only over 60 finishers of RAM. We'll wish him and the team a lot of luck for 2013. We have to get out of here. Thank you so much for listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.